Questions? The vest is all I'm taking off. Don't worry. Yes. When are you getting them back? At 4:40. In 58 minutes. Okay. That assumes that Julie can get me to stop. Okay. Other questions? The exam analyses that you did on the first exam are here on the table to pick up if you didn't get yours. And there is a second analysis assignment for up to 5 points, and the instructions for that are on the website today. So when you get your exam back, you can hang on to it and look at that analysis. If you did not do the analysis for the first exam, you may do that analysis for the second exam. So if you missed those points, for whatever reason, we're not worried about what the reason is, you may do the original analysis, but on the second exam. And the instructions for that are still on the web. So you'll see that on the news page. Okay? Do you have any announcements, Julie? No? Okay. We'll give you a little feedback on the exam on Wednesday after we've had a chance to confer about that. Remind me. Okay. And that brings us back to where we were Wednesday, which was talking about language. And just to recap a little of that, I had suggested that language is an arbitrary system of, language is a system of arbitrary symbols arranged in orderly fashion. And part of the complexity of language is that the symbols are arbitrary, and the task is to get the meaning that the speaker has uttered in a way that can be comprehended by the other person. So language is essentially a social process. That doesn't mean that you have to be in relationship in order to develop language. According to Noam Chomsky and others, the brain is designed to create symbols and to create an organization for them. So language is innate, and it doesn't necessarily have to result from social transactions. But most of us pick up language in our social transactions as toddlers and young children, and we develop a system for representing our ideas in words and putting them out so that other people can receive them. And we also develop the complementary process of receptive language. We have the productive end, we produce the utterances, and we also have the receptive end of language, which allows us to interpret and make sense, we hope, out of what other people say. Either of those processes can be affected by problems in the brain or in the auditory nerve or in the ear. And one of the things that I didn't say that's reported in the text is that children typically understand much more than they can produce. So children may not be able to create complex sentences until well after they are able to comprehend those same sentences, and follow instructions, for example. So the productive end appears to be ahead of the, the receptive end tends to be ahead of the productive end. And I also was getting to the point that figuring out what words refer to, what their reference are, is half of the battle. Children begin to create language, to construct language, when they get the notion that words refer to some characteristic or some object or some action or some feature of their experience. Being able to communicate effectively requires that we be able to share words with other people in a way that involves both of us having the same referent, having the same understanding. And that, of course, is where we run into problems in using language. We often know what we think, but we can't put it into words. We often struggle to find the words to put our ideas into so that other people can understand. This, of course, is particularly relevant to having just graded an exam. Since your attempt was to take what you understand, put it into words in a way that Julie and I can understand, and sometimes we're less proficient at making ourselves understood than we would like to be. We argue a lot about what we mean, semantic arguments. One of the issues in working with couples often is that they're using words in different ways, and they're arguing about how they're using them. And often the arguments boil down to just simply disagreeing or not understanding each other when they would really like to understand each other but can't figure out how to share the meaning. I won't bore you with details of those. You probably have your own. The last point I was making was that according to Chomsky, as described in the text and elaborated on in lecture and on the website, the way to understand the organization of language is to understand that we use a set of rules which are based on innate ways that the brain processes information. And the rules are represented in the grammar that holds our language together, that tells us what we can say, how to say it, how to transform what we mean in any particular way. So in Chomsky's transformational grammar, each of the rules represents a way to change your meaning. So we have ways to negate, we have ways to multiply, we have ways to refer to the past or something that might happen in the future, and each of those rules represents the grammar that we tried to teach you in junior high school. Once we learn a rule, we can apply it. And we can use it to generate an infinite number of examples. And the example that I may have lost the overhead for. There it is. I gave the example of being able to generate the plural of a nonsense word, and you demonstrated quite well that you could do that. And then with the verb, being able to put it in the past tense by adding ed, or the future tense by adding the helper I will clag. We know how to do that. Language is generative. And Chomsky provides us lots of opportunities and lots of examples to look at how children are able to generate an infinite variety of sentences or utterances to represent what they mean as they develop each of the rules. And the point I was making at the very end of class was that you know those rules, you know how to generate all of those potential sentences, you do that very efficiently, you understand when a rule is being used appropriately, when it's being violated, you recognize incorrect grammar, unless you haven't learned it specifically, and there are fine points in any language that some of us don't learn. That's why we have editors. And you probably can use a wide variety of transformational grammar rules without being able to label them, without even recognizing that they do have labels, because that's what we tried to teach you in eighth grade, the labels for the passive indicative tense and all of those sorts of wonderful things that I don't know either. The generation of examples often leads to children saying things that are grammatically correct but never heard before. And let me give you an example of that. This one was generated by my favorite child. Oh, don't tell her brother I said that. One of my two favorite children. And this came up in a situation when she was almost three. And she was doing what children love to do. She was climbing over the back of the couch in the living room. And Daddy was doing what daddies often do, which was I was reading the paper and ignoring her, of course. And I wasn't sitting on the couch. But she was going up on the couch, and then she would climb over and drop down between the couch and the wall, and this was fairly safe, and she was fairly agile, so I wasn't worrying about it. I did know what she was doing. But as smart children will do, she was narrating her activities. And I'll just pass that along as one of the ways that you can very quickly figure out whether a child of three or four is bright. Bright kids narrate their experience. They just talk all the time. And they generate an infinite variety of sentences to let the world know what they're doing. Eventually, they will put that inside and stop talking out loud all the time, most of them. And then they will be thinking linguistically, but doing it to themselves. But they'll be instructing themselves, they'll be telling themselves what to do, just not sharing it with everybody who's around. So Gwen was climbing over the back of the couch, and she was narrating her experience. She was saying things like, "Daddy, look at me," over the top of the paper. "Look what I'm doing. I'm climbing. I'm climbing over the couch. I'm climbing over the back of the couch. I'm falling down to the floor. I'm climbing back," and the way the couch was constructed, she could climb back up from the back over and drop. And the couch back was fairly high, and it also had a wooden frame, so it with springlies on it, decorative kind of Queen Anne or something, style, anyway, one of those things. And she was climbing over and sort of scraping her abdomen on the wooden frame. And she was doing this over and over and over again. And she was getting a lot of exercise, which Daddy was cheering because that meant she would go to sleep easily. I wasn't narrating that to her, but that's what why I was encouraging her to do it. And she finally got to the point where she was saying that she really needed to be admired for this activity that she was doing, She does it really well. And it's not easy to do. And she said, it's hard. It's hard. And I said, yeah, okay. I'm doing it, and it's hard. I do it with... Now, what I did with you with the wugs and the clagging was to give you the stem of a sentence and let you fill in the blanks. So here's the kid about three telling me that something's hard, and she wants to create a noun phrase. She doesn't know that's what she wants to do. She's already playing around in her mind with the adverbial form. She doesn't know that's what she's doing. But how would you finish that sentence? She's doing this thing that's pretty hard to do. And she knows this form. I do it with... How would you finish that? With agility, yeah. But her meaning was not that she did it well, but that it was difficult to do. Okay. This was a hard thing to do. So she's thinking of the effort that goes into it. So how would you finish the sentence? I do it with... Now, she wanted to indicate that it wasn't easy. So if it's not easy, it's hard. I do it with... Difficulty. Yeah, I do it with difficulty. You can do that. Something is hard, it's difficult. Hard and difficult are synonyms. Okay, so I do it with difficulty. Problem. She didn't have the word difficulty in her vocabulary. So she's generated a stem. She can't finish it. So what do you do? Well, there is a way. She knew it was hard. So she hesitated, repeated the stem, and generated the noun. I do it with hardens. She knew it was hard. Daddy stopped reading the paper. What did he say? Ah, Chomsky, you rule. It's a generative grammar. She can take the root that this is hard. It's an adjective. It's hard to do. Still an adjective. I do it with hardens. What I don't know is how she would have spelled it. Okay, I don't need to know. You can do that with E or you can do it with A. Right? Other words that you do that with. Other examples that fit that rule. Reliance. Okay? Reliance turns a verb. Is that what you said? Compliance. You comply. I'm sorry. I wasn't being very compliant. Okay. Okay. There's an example where you're taking a verb and turning it into a noun. And we often do that with the ANCE form. I rely, I'm reliant. You can do the I-A-N-T to turn the verb into an adjective. You can do the A-N-C-E to turn it into the noun. Other examples? Endurance. Endure. Endurance. How about an adjective to noun transformation? Usually with an E, N-C-E, in English. Are you independent? Independence. I'm independent. I do it with independence. We all recognize that form and the transformations. We don't think of them as, oh, this is an adjective to noun transformation, or this is a verb to noun transformation. But we can all do it and we all recognize it. She could generate it. It's not in the dictionary. Nobody's put it in print, therefore it's not in the dictionary. It's not commonly used. But it communicated her purpose, and it provides an excellent illustration of grammar as generative. If you know the rule, you can create the sentence that communicates what it is you mean. You also, in some languages, have to learn the exceptions to the rules. The text describes kids as overgeneralizing. So once you acquire the rule, you can apply it infinitely. But in English, you also have to learn the exceptions. So we know that we make something past tense by adding ed. Last night I clagged. But in some cases, I go to town today, yesterday I goed, right? And when kids make those mistakes, they're demonstrating that they have the rule, but they haven't learned all the exceptions yet. Some languages don't have exceptions. Some languages are completely consistent. They don't have those silly past tenses that require changing the verb instead of just adding a suffix to it. In English, unfortunately, and the reason that English is so difficult to learn is that it has thousands of exceptions. And particularly in our verb forms. One of the reasons it has those exceptions is that we took so many of them from nasty other languages like Saxon and variations of German. Not that I'm against those languages, it's just that kids are smarter than adults. If kids could do their thing and rule the world, English would have no exceptions and it would be phonetically spelled. And that would eliminate a huge number of the problems that kids have in school. We give them a language that is extremely difficult to learn. They've got the rules, they can do the phonetics and the rules, and then we make them learn all of these meaningless, from their perspective, exceptions. The process of learning language involves having your utterances expanded and corrected, and that's what parents and teachers and others do. Somebody makes a mistake, we correct it. Kid says something that we don't quite understand, we expand it. We provide more detail. And every time we do that, the other person processes that and says, aha, okay, that helps me understand how to put my thought into words. All right. Let's move us on a bit. What does language do for us? I already talked about it, letting you convey your meaning. It lets us share meaning with other people. And that means that we can tell people about things that they've not experienced. When you're dealing with an infant or a toddler who's non-linguistic, you only know what happens with the child when you're with the child. And the child can share experience with you, but you have to be present. You have to be in the same time and space to share experience with the child. As the child develops language, the child becomes able to tell you about what happened when you weren't there. So it's transcending time and space. It's telling you later about something that it did. It's asking you what you did earlier or what you're going to do. So language lets us bridge across the past and the present and the future. It frees us from the necessity of sharing experience directly with another person. So it expands the world infinitely. It allows you to develop relationships with other people and maintain them even in their absence. In that sense, it's almost as good as a cell phone or text message. Well, those are based on language, though. So, they make the text message and the cell phone and the email possible. Otherwise, we'd have to have video and show the other person what we were doing all the time, and we would still be dependent on time and space. You can create ideas. Language doesn't just convey what we mean, it creates meaning. So when you hear somebody talk about something, you develop your understanding, your image of what that person might have experienced. So you can share experiences in part because language stimulates imagination. Language is fundamental to interpersonal relationships. You can have them without sharing language, but they are facilitated by having them. And that brings me to the next unit directly, which is personality and social. So we have talked about biology. We've added the cognitive to that. And we've begun to add the psychological and interpersonal to that. Okay? So, what are we going to focus on? Well, there are several things that I want you to come away with. We're going to talk about temperament, how we are different from each other in some important ways that appear to be biological. We're going to go back to the biology and look at differences among us. Can I just point to that and it'll turn off, right? No. I need a remote for the light. We're going to talk about attachment. How do we create those relationships that are important to us? Why are we emotionally connected to other people? My wife said this morning she'd gotten pictures of our favorite almost one-year-old who's away for the year, and she said it made her cry because she can't be with him until maybe March or February if she goes to visit. Why is she so attached to somebody else's baby? How does that happen? How do we become emotionally connected to other people? How do babies do that? What difference does the parents make? How can we understand the impact that parents have? How do peer relationships change? What do you do with your friends? How does somebody go from being a friend to being a romantic partner to being an ex-friend or an enemy? How do those changes take place? How does physical development affect the psychosocial? How does cognitive development affect the psychosocial development? And then how do the relationships that we have affect the physical and the cognitive developments that we go through. How do you define maturity? Your parents tell you to be mature, right? Don't act like that, you're immature. What do they mean? How do you define that? What does it mean to be a mature person? Am I mature just because my hair is white? How do family relationships change across the lifespan? And how do the relationships that you have affect your development? Does it make a difference if you are partnered, for example? Are you healthier? Are you smarter if you're partnered? Do you live longer? Does it make a difference if you're male or female? How does the work that you do affect your development? How do you construct a life? What's your life story going to be? How do people figure out what impact they've had in the world, whether life is worth, their life is worth having been lived? We're going to be looking at temperament, attachment, a little bit at self-concept, roles, the notion of identity, and intimacy in relationships. So as you read the text, and I'll remind you that this unit has twice as much reading as each of the other texts, units had, as you read it, think about these concepts and watch for them particularly. And that list is on the website. We're going to talk about biology first, and I'm going to assert and then later try to support the notion that if we go back to genetics, we go back to how we're different from each other from conception on, there are two really big differences. And one of those is sex. Some of us have two X chromosomes, some of us have an X and a Y. We are different in some fundamental ways. So we'll take a little bit of a look at sex differences, although we're not going to focus on that. The text spends more time looking at that, but not in a particularly systematic way. Temperament. Temperament is considered to have a biological basis, probably in part genetic, although there's some influence that experience prenatally may be important in creating the differences among us that we're born with. Temperament refers to the kinds of characteristics that we demonstrate when we're dealing with input from the world and the style of our output. Some people process things much more quickly than others. Some people finish sentences before you do. Some people think a long time before they make a decision. Some people are typically anxious in new situations. Some people are bold and don't worry about what other people think of them. Those differences have their roots in differences among infants, and some of them we can detect in the first 3 or 4 months of life, before parents have had much impact on what kind of personality you may have. So we'll look at temperament and how we classify it and what happens to it, what might impact on it. Biology also provides the foundation for emotion, our physiological reactions to events. Newborns respond to lack of oxygen. Newborns respond, usually negatively, to loud noises, big surprises, having the base knocked out from under them, and they get dropped on the floor. They generally don't like that, and they have emotional reactions to it. Newborns also have emotional reactions to being soothed and comforted, stroked, held, moved around in rhythmic ways. They like that. That's an emotion. They feel good when we treat them in ways that make them feel good. Those are physiological reactions to events that we experience, including the internal processes. I can feel good because my tummy is just right full, and my diaper's not wet, and I'm not constipated, and my bladder's not too full. That's an internal process. I can feel good because I'm, as an adult, because I'm thinking about things that I like to do, thinking about things that I have done. So it's an internal process. The infant's emerging variety of emotions follow along with neurological maturation. The newborn doesn't express all the possible emotions. And the text has a pretty good description. And I'll even tell you where. Probably pages 189 to 195. The problem with taking off my vest is that I covered up my notes with it. There we go. Yeah, 189 to 195 describes the differentiation of emotional expression that infants go through. The expectable ages at which you will see disgust, for example, as an emotional reaction. And the changes and the differentiation between the emotional reactions that infants can display go pretty much along with maturation of the nervous system. So as the brain matures, what the baby feels and how it can express that changes. As the body, and I will add the mind, develop, the ways we can express ourselves change, and the ways we can relate to other people change. We mentioned that when we talked about walking. When you walk or crawl quickly, you can get away from people if you don't want to be near them. Or if you want to be near them, you can go hunt for them. You can search for them. You can follow them. You can chase them. So the ways we express our attachments, our likes and our dislikes change as we develop. The mind provides the basis for making sense of our experience, including the experience we have of social interaction. How do we make sense out of the fact that we have these caregivers who make us feel good, who show up when we scream, who keep us warm, who feed us, who put us to bed when we're tired, who comfort us when we're upset? How do we make sense out of that in our minds? How do we come to understand the fact that these people actually care for us? They anticipate sometimes, if they're really good, they anticipate what we need. The mental processes, the cognitive processes, are providing the basis for that understanding. We're also going to come to understand gradually ourselves. We're going to develop a self-concept. Newborns don't come with one. And they're not even particularly, they don't give us much evidence that they even know that they exist. But a little later, over the course of the first year, they will begin to give us information that suggests that they know that they exist. You'll read about that in the text. We develop understanding of other people. We develop understanding of our social transactions. We can put ourselves in relationship with other people. Examples. How are you supposed to treat your roommate? What is the roommate relationship? Some of you know Some of you don't. Some of you have roommates that you wish knew how to treat a roommate because they're mistreating you. Where do we learn those things? How do we come to understand what is expected? What is a boyfriend? Some of you had boyfriends, remember? In sixth grade, fifth grade, fourth grade. You called him a boyfriend. You told your parents you were going out, which really meant you were sitting together at lunch if you could make him do that and get him away from his friends. When did you start learning what you were supposed to do as a boyfriend, as a girlfriend? How many of us get into relationships along the way where we disagree on the definition and the expectations of the roles of boyfriend and girlfriend? Or sometimes more dramatically, husband and wife? Or parent? Where do we define? How do we make sense? Where do we get the experience that leads us to have an understanding of how we're supposed to behave in relationships? And then on the broader level, where do we fit? We're also going to be developing a notion of where we fit in the world. Am I privileged? Am I white? Am I male? Am I old? Am I powerful? Am I powerless? Do I have any impact? Am I a burden? How do I come to understand myself in the social context? We're going to talk about emotion and intellect, and I'm going to start that today. So I'm going to skip over that for a minute and talk briefly about emotional connections to other people. We form connections. We develop attachments with our parents, hopefully. We develop connections with our peers of different types. And as we get older, we develop connections with the next generation, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our students, and other people. Connections change. How you are connected to a 3-year-old may be quite different from how you're connected with a 33-year-old as a parent. So the connections change. Some connections are lost. And often in human development, it's the social connections that are being developed, the interpersonal connections that are changing, and or the interpersonal connections that are being lost, that drive our behavior. And so interpersonal relationships and attachments particularly are very important to us. So we're going to look at some of the more important ones through this unit. How do we understand the changes when they take place? And then finally, in this unit, we're going to talk a little bit about finding a place and a path in the world, creating an identity, what that means, what is a sense of identity. We're going to talk about Kagan and the notion of moral feelings and behavior in children. Are we all essentially moral? And what does it take for us to become immoral? Or are we, as others would argue, innately greedy, nasty, bad, and evil, and it takes particular characteristics to turn us into nice people? Where do we start? How do you develop a career? Well, you come on Wednesday night from 6 to 8. Or, many of you are already started, some of you already have pretty good progress toward a lifelong career. And then we'll prepare to leave the world and the semester and the course. We'll get there at the end. Okay. I said we were going to talk about emotions and the relationship between emotion and thinking, or emotion and cognition. So I want to talk about one of my favorite theorists, a guy named Murray Bowen. Murray Bowen is not mentioned in the text. That's what lectures are for. I get to talk about the people who aren't mentioned in the text that I think are really fun and helpful and worth talking about, worth understanding. And this unit gives me more opportunity to do that than any of the others. Just take that with a bit of a warning. Let me, truth in advertising here. I talk about the people that I think are really useful in understanding interpersonal development. So I'm going to talk about Bowen, who's not in the text. I'm going to talk about Eric Erickson, who is, but in an inadequate way. And I'm going to talk about Harry Stack Sullivan. And you might question if the text represents the field of human development, is my interest in people who aren't considered important enough to be in the text an indication that I'm totally out of touch with the field? That's a possibility. So just keep that in mind. That maybe I like people who aren't terribly important. I'll let you judge for yourself whether or not they're useful. So let me talk about Murray Bowen. Bowen was a psychiatrist, and he was one of the primary movers in the field of family systems theory and therapy. Among his contributions was the notion that when you're looking at somebody who has a psychiatric problem, disturbed behavior, real weird oddities, people don't just generally develop those notions, particularly not children, on their own. They're usually reflecting something that is going on in a family. Not always, but often. And if you're going to treat them, it's helpful to involve the rest of the family in the process. We're not going to talk about family therapy. If you want to do that, then take HDFS 260 later, in which we'll look at that as a system. But Bowen, also in trying to figure out relationships within families, found it necessary and helpful to come up with some way of explaining the emotions that characterize our relationships and why some of us have a lot of difficulty with relationships and why some people seem to enjoy wonderfully rewarding and rich and wonderful relationships. How do you explain that? So Bowen suggested that we first need to understand emotions, and then we need to understand how they develop, and then we can move toward a definition of emotional maturity. Because one way to describe people who have lousy relationships and are terrible friends and cause pain in their relationships or have a lot of anxiety about them, you can talk about them as emotionally immature. And people who have easy relationships and find it not difficult to create relationships and enjoy them and nurture them and deal with emotions, their own and other people's, he would call them emotionally mature. So how do we define that? We start with emotions. Experience creates connections between situations and our emotional response. As I said, if you drop a baby, it will cry. If you treat it roughly and surprise it and annoy it, it will get irritated. If you do that long enough, it'll get paranoid. It takes a long time to get to that point, but you can teach a kid to be very wary and be afraid and fearful. We create connections between the situations and the emotional responses that we feel in those situations. So if a situation is repeated often enough, we develop a schema about it. I'm throwing that in from Piaget. Bowen didn't talk about schemas, but it's a consistent notion. We develop a set of expectations about particular people or about particular situations. And we begin to respond emotionally in anticipation of those experiences. So when I say I'm going home for Christmas and I'm going to spend a week with my family, I'm just making this up, I'm not going to do that, but if I were to say that, and I'm going home at Christmas and I'm going to have Christmas with my family and I'm going to spend a whole week with my parents and siblings and grandparents, some of you would hear that as a wonderful recipe for a marvelous time of reconnecting, of fun, of laughter, of great food, of the smell of cinnamon, of holiday foods, and real appreciation and warmth, right? Some of you would experience that as a recipe for trying to figure out how to get out of it, because you have these really warped family members, this really terrible relationship. Everybody gets upset at Christmas and they end up hating each other and they vow they're never going to celebrate again, right? None of you, but you know people who have that emotional reaction to that situation because over the years that's what's happened to them. One of my favorite can't tell that one. Okay. I used to hang out with a woman who always got upset around Christmas time, and it would happen, it would begin at tree trimming time. And she would get really squirrely and irritable. And it was kind of difficult to figure that out. I like trimming trees. I think Christmas is a fun sort of celebration and is fun to do. But she would get squirrely and anxious and then snappish. And so at one point I asked her about this, and she said, well, it was very interesting to her that I noticed it because she was unaware of it. She just hated Christmas. Okay. Why do you hate Christmas? Because every time they decorated the tree, her parents would end up screaming at each other. And Christmas morning, opening presents to her, was always, in her memory, always characterized by major disappointment expressed by her father, who never felt that his presents were appreciated enough, that kids were never enjoying it enough, while he was badgering them about why they weren't appreciating the presents that he had chosen after a 3-martini lunch the day before Christmas Eve. He would always work in the morning and then go downtown and go to a particular store and start at the top. He'd have 3-martini lunch, and then he'd start at the top of the store and go down to the bottom and then head home after having bought all kinds of things that didn't fit, weren't appropriate, but the more the merrier in his view, and everybody should really appreciate all the effort that he put into this. And so Christmas was a hated experience in this family. And she carried that with her. That's an example of, in her case, fairly slow triggering. When she came up to the similar experience every year, she would begin to anticipate the nastiness that had characterized Christmas in her experience. And she would begin to get anxious. And eventually, she would get flooded. She would get flooded by the experience, by the emotions. And she would... What happens when you get flooded, you're asking? What happens when you get flooded by emotions is that you can't think, you don't think, and you are typically irrational. And depending on what you've learned to do, you may either sit down in a puddle, you may curl up in a fetal position and pull the blankets over your head, you may lash out at other people because obviously they are making you upset. I'm sorry, that may not be obvious, but when you are flooded by your emotions, you're typically not at your very best. Some of us are more easily flooded by our emotions than others. Part of growing up emotionally is to figure out how not to be flooded by our emotions, how to maintain our rational thought processes even when we're very upset. And part of growing up emotionally is to figure out how to respond to other people when they are flooded. How do you deal with somebody who is totally out of control? Somebody who is crying, somebody who is unable to think, unable to make a decision, unable to do anything because he is experiencing very strong emotions. So part of growing up emotionally is to figure out how we deal with our own and figure out how to deal with other people's emotions. Emotions are contagious. And there are no flu shots for them. Emotions are contagious for newborns. Anybody who's worked in the newborn nursery knows that one of the things that you try to do as quickly as possible when one kid starts to cry is pop a pacifier in that mouth or remove that child. Because if you don't, what's going to happen? They're all going to cry. That's right. Same thing happens in childcare when you have a group of children. The same thing happens at funerals with adults. Same thing happens in my office. If you come in and start to cry, I'll cry. I promise. I always do. What happens when you're talking with somebody in a group and one person is so happy about something that he starts to cry? Everybody starts to cry. Now, some of us pretend we're not, but we cry. Emotions are contagious. Probably the survival of human beings as a species depends on that contagiousness. We experience other people's emotions, we respond to them empathetically, and that is built into us. It's also a problem. What do you do with the fact that somebody is sitting in your office crying about something and you're crying? What do you do with that? Well, that's okay. Crying is okay. I don't mind crying. What if somebody is really angry at you? That's contagious too. If somebody is screaming at you and threatening you and telling you what they're going to do to you, you're likely to become angry. Some of us just get scared, wet our pants, and escape. But others of us want to hit back. We want to threaten back. So we get into a shouting match with the bully, with the person who's angry. The fact that we experience emotions in our relationships, other people have a wonderful ability to trigger emotions in us, and the fact that our emotions are contagious create a major issue for us in development. We have to figure out what to do about our own, how to understand them and how to express them, and we have to figure out what to do with the other person's emotions and our response to theirs. And we'll talk about what Bowen says about that on Wednesday. Right now, I get 2 points for this. I get 2 points. See what I did? I remembered, and I stopped on time without being lassoed. Okay. Now,